From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. May 1st is fast approaching, D-Day for high school seniors to decide what college they will attend next year if they're going to college, and it's no easy decision for them or their parents. Just paying for college is a huge financial undertaking, with costs soaring well over $30,000 a year at many private colleges. And then there's the question of where a young man or woman ought to go to college. Is rejection from the tip-top school a catastrophe? Does acceptance make enrollment a no-brainer? New research suggests that going to a prestigious, high-priced college does not mean greater future earning potential, and that many students could be just as well off going to less selective schools. Do you buy it? What value do you place on going to prestige U? And how are you making the college decision with your own family? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is New York Times economics editor Tom Redburn. His Sunday column looked at research into whether highly selective and highly expensive colleges confer any real benefit in later life. Good evening and welcome, Tom Redburn.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Real well. Thanks for being with us. And from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Tom Redburn, take us into this research. What are the new studies focused on, and what are they telling us?
Well, this is some new research that was done by a professor at Princeton University, Alan Krueger, and a colleague of his, Stacy Dale.
And they are economists, I guess.
They are economists. And this is they've been doing this kind of research for a few years. It's based on looking at a lot of students who there's a lot of data on who graduated from college or actually entered colleges in the mid-70s, and they looked at how much money they were making in the mid-90s.
Okay.
And really what they found was that, you know, what you would expect on the first order, which is that students who go to top colleges overall tend to make more money than those who go to less selective schools. You know, if you go to Penn over Penn State, overall you're going to make maybe $20,000 more at that stage of your life than the average person at the less selective school.
That is sort of 20 years later, 20 years on.
20 years later. But what they did is they said, well, you know, the student who goes to Penn over Penn State or Harvard over Ohio State has already got a head up. He's probably already a little smarter, a little more ambitious. And so that's not surprising that on average they would do better. So what they did is they looked at the same kinds of students. They looked at students who applied to top schools and for whatever reason either chose to go there or did not, went to a less selective school. And when you look at those kids, they all end up about the same. So I think the overall conclusion they came to was that it really doesn't matter as much where you go, it's who you are.
Meaning, if you're headed in that direction and have the ambition to aim high, whether you get into that top school or not may not make much difference in financial terms in your life.
It may not make much difference in financial terms. Now, of course, you know, money's not everything. It's probably not even the most important thing. But it does matter to a lot of people, and it probably matters to their parents more than it should. But
I suppose is this more
of a student who's going to college next year too?
So you're in the midst of this yourself.
Absolutely. That's why I wanted to write about it, because we were going through it ourselves.
And has what you found in these studies managed to factor into your own family's decisions, or is this just a college egghead stuff, and it's still the same old pressures at your kitchen table?
I think it's the same old pressures overall. Although I think that for my daughter in this case, I don't think it was prestige so much. I think she wanted to go to a school where there were a lot of other smart kids. Mm-hmm. And those schools tend to be expensive, but it wasn't necessarily that she wanted to go to a school that had a prestigious name. So she didn't really, you know, she didn't apply to Brown. She didn't apply to, you know, many of the Ivy League colleges. She applied to a lot of selective small liberal arts colleges because she felt that was a good fit for her. So, you know, part of what, you know, the big name and the prestige was not as important to her. But on the other hand, she also wanted to be surrounded by a bunch of kids who were going to be ambitious and talented and pusher, too.
Well, you have to ask, is this study out of Princeton really anything more than just common sense, that there are smart people everywhere?
It's a little more than common sense, because what it's really kind of – what was even most surprising was even if you were rejected by a top college, you ended up later in life doing as well as the kids who went there. So what I really said was – You know, if you really have the ambition, if you have the drive, and you think you've got the moxie to think you can go to a top school, you're probably going to succeed as well as the kids who end up going there. So that does suggest that the education itself doesn't necessarily lead to a higher income.
Tom,
the education leads to some other things probably that are important to people, too.
Well, how about that? This particular study looked at earning potential, but other studies have looked at those non-cost factors, non-money-related factors, like academic atmosphere, the kind of people they'll meet, connections they'll make, and so on.
Absolutely. There's some counter-research by other economists, probably most notably Gordon Winston, who's an economist at Williams College, which is, you know, a very prestigious selective college in Massachusetts. And he found that there's really a benefit for sort of the concentration of smart students. And the way he tried to do this was he brought together a group of students with high SAT scores with a group of students that didn't necessarily have quite as high SAT scores.
And how did he measure the benefit as an economist?
Well, he had them have a discussion and then write an essay. And their research, again, it's a little more subjective, but their research tended to say that the kids who benefited from a more stimulating discussion with, quote, smarter students ended up writing better essays.
So they may not make any more money 20 years later, but they may have fancier conversations.
They may have fancier conversations. They may be better at cocktail parties. They may have richer inner lives. They may enjoy the theater more. And also, he disputes a little bit of what Alan Krueger found, because his argument is that the kids who choose to go to the less selective college may have done so partly because, you know, they were offered merit a scholarship, or they were driven by other factors other than, you know, the best education. And maybe they're kind of money-grubbing kids anyway, and they're the ones who are going to go out and, on average, make more money anyway. Now, that's his theory. You know, he's pushing schools like Williams. Alan Krueger, teaches at Princeton. He's got an elite school, too, but he tried to look at it the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, you know what a pressurized time it is in any family's life when they approach the month that we're in right now of a child's senior year in high school.
Oh, it's a unique moment for parents, because you're suddenly, you know, face to face with grim issues. You know, Tom uses words like smart and ambitious. I would use words like class and money. I mean, a lot of what we call merit in this life is luck in slow motion. And at such moments, parents have to just sort of gauge their whole lives and say to their children, this is what you can have, this is what you can't have. But, you know, this whole business of econometric studies of schools, some years ago, University of North Carolina did a study, what of their departments produced the highest earning graduates? And you know what they found? Wasn't engineering, wasn't science, geography. Why? Michael Jordan major in geography.
And it skewed the whole scale.
It skewed the whole scale. So very interesting what you can do with numbers.
It sure is. Tom Redburn, everybody at this moment is trying to, who's in that position to make that decision, is trying to make these enormous, compass settings for themselves or their children on the basis of, in my experience, very little real good measures of how to decide. It often comes down to such small things, a comment that a child overheard somewhere from someone that they respect once, or a 1-2-hour visit on a family vacation.
That's absolutely true, and that's certainly been our experience. But I don't know that there is any better way. I mean, I obviously class and, you know, the kinds of people who drive BMWs and the kinds of people who, you know, drive Fords, all of those things play a role in what kind of aspirations you might have for your children, what aspirations your children have. And, obviously, the more elite groups of American society, the pressure is even more intense for this. I think probably a lot of places, they don't get quite as excited about whether their kid's going to get into Harvard or not. But in the places that it does seem to matter to them, I think that, you know, this is a real kind of entry into adult life for a lot of kids. It's the first time they may really get rejected, and that's probably pretty hard for them. And some of them think that, you know, because they were rejected, somehow or another they're lesser worth. And I think that's one of the things this study is trying to say is,
that's
wrong. Relax a little. You know, there's a lot of good places to go to college, first of all. full range, and it doesn't necessarily mean the college that rejected you is any better for you than the college that accepted you.
And that is and ought to be a comfort. I want to bring in Bruce Hammond. He's co-author of the Fisk Guide to Getting into the Right College. Good evening and welcome, Bruce Hammond.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Bruce, I don't know if you've seen the studies that Tom Redburn's been writing about in the New York Times that say the gilt-edged college, in purely financial terms, and of course there's a much bigger universe than that, but in purely financial terms, may not guarantee anything different for kids who try to get in and didn't, schools a tier or two down may produce graduates earning just as much 20 years on. Does that surprise you?
It really doesn't, and I'll say I've seen the reports, and this isn't the first study that's come out questioning the economic value of a prestige degree, and my hunch, just coming to it, having worked with kids for 12 years as a school counselor, is that it's probably true that we overemphasize the potential economic value. Economics is not what's driving this craze for highly selective colleges. If it were by chance one day to be definitively proven that these schools conveyed no economic benefit, do you think all of a sudden Harvard would be having trouble filling its beds?
So what's driving it, Bruce Hammond?
It is much more to do with how we convey distinction in this society that we have without, an aristocracy. How do we measure distinction for young people? This college selection process has become a rite of passage, and so there are two issues here. There's where's the right college for me to go in the next 4 years, and that's been superimposed on another issue, which is where do I rank in the pecking order of this prestige-granting mechanism that we've created. And that, to me, sometimes overrides the fit between student and school.
Is that a new phenomenon?
I don't think it's new. I think that it's been accentuated by the media, and I would take it back to 1985 when U.S. News and World Report came out with its first ranking of the colleges. They weren't the first people who had tried to do such a thing, but really it brought into everyone's living room every year these measures of distinction. And so people, parents are carrying these things around, and over the last 10 or 20 years with the competition for admission at these schools intensifying, rejection always creates anxiety, which creates more obsession. And so I think this is just a social phenomenon that we've been seeing for at least 20 years.
And with that U.S. News ranking, it creates also a kind of unified field. Wherever you are in the country, suddenly you're comparing your state school to every other state school and every private school in the nation in terms of ranking.
Right. Right. I think there has been a counter trend, though, in the last few years, if I could highlight that, and that is these expensive colleges have gotten so outrageously expensive, and they've chosen a pricing strategy which jacks up the sticker price and then gives discounts, either need-based or merit-based. But they have the market to charge these incredible increases. I think a few more families, at any rate, are opting out and are saying, hey, let me go to University of Michigan or University of Arizona with maybe a nice scholarship and, gosh, save $100,000. I see that in my students that I counsel. Some of them are beginning to question the logic that we've had handed down in the last 10 or 20 years.
Tom Redburn, do you think the studies that you cite in the Times may give some more propulsion to that trend?
I don't think so. I think it will be more what he said. I think it'll be more the sheer shock value, sticker price that drives that a little bit. But at least as these colleges are measuring themselves, they're still succeeding very much. They're rejecting even more students. I mean, I think I was looking at some stuff for the classes right now that there are. Williams only accepted about 20% of the students who applied. Last year it was closer to 30%. Stanford and Harvard were 10 to 12%. Last year it was 18%, that kind of thing. So they're all getting even harder to get into.
Which means that the exclusive get even more exclusive.
Right, and then that probably impels people to try, more people to apply because they think that somehow gives them greater merit.
Oh, boy, is there no end to this. Tom Redburn, economics editor at the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
We're talking about college admissions and college choices. What is the value add in a gilt-edged college diploma? If prestige doesn't pay out in lifetime earnings, does it still matter? What's in a name? In the college game, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about college admissions and big decisions being made right now in families around kitchen tables all over this country about where young people, young men and women, will go to college. Are you sweating bullets in your house right now over college admissions and where to go? How are you or your high school senior deciding where to enroll? And are we driving ourselves and our children crazy in the pursuit of brand name educations? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Bruce Hammond. He's co-author of The Fisk Guide to Getting into the Right College. He also wrote Discounts and Deals at the Nation's 360 Best Colleges, and he is Director of College Counseling at Sandia Preparatory School in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're also joined right now by Maureen. Welcome, Maureen. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
We're in the middle of this. In fact, I was just in the kitchen. What we're going to do this weekend is a chart. I mean, I spent 5 days and then plus two more revisiting the schools that my son got into to figure out, you know, so he can figure out where to go. And the problem we're having is, how do we figure out what is the most important reason for him to go to A, B, C, or D?
What are you weighing, Maureen?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, one of the things that I've said to my son is, I don't want you to make class the reason that you go to this school or to that school.
Well, that's very big of you.
Well, it is really big of me, but I mean, I don't, because they're all so expensive. I mean, it almost, except for one school, which is McGill University in Montreal,
right?
The schools are oppressively expensive.
What's the range of cost you're looking at, Maureen?
Okay, well, the range is huge, $34,000 to $38,000. I mean, we're talking about $4,000. What difference does that make? I mean, if you're talking about three schools, and that's the range.
Right. So Maureen, give us a sense, and then we'll throw it to Bruce Hammond of the schools that your son's choosing between.
Well, he's looking at McGill, Boston College, NYU, and Fordham University.
Okay.
He's gotten merit scholarships, excuse me, from three of them. They operate differently. I mean, they don't give financial aid students generally to people from this country. But on the other hand, he would be getting a first-class education.
Sure.
In American dollars.
Let's give it to Bruce Hammond. Bruce, here are the choices.
$13,000.
It's a big difference. But Bruce, I know you don't know Maureen's son in this case,
right.
But how do you begin to advise a parent and most importantly, the young man or woman who's facing this kind of decision?
Well, I think her son made a mistake in getting into four. He should have only gotten into one, and that would have made it a lot easier.
Well, I was thinking about that because we could be talking about, you know, it's really great. Isn't it great? We don't have to run around. We can think about what's best about this one. We can think about what kind of clothes you'll need for the climate. Well, forget that.
I had that very conversation with somebody today trying to choose between MIT and Princeton. You know, it depends on the student. Some people like to do a chart and be very organized.
We're doing a chart.
And maybe you did that already.
No, we're doing it this weekend.
In your kitchen. You know, the gut feeling is important. You can look at the different characters of the institution. You've got a couple that are Catholic-affiliated there that may have a little bit of different tenor. Of course, McGill is a little bit of an outlier being in Montreal. That's a completely different experience. I think as long as he's seen all of them with students in session, he's got a good way to make the decision, and it just comes down, hopefully he'll feel it in his gut. You know, that's great expert advice there, but I think sometimes we know subconsciously it's more like choosing a mate than, I don't know, buying a stereo system.
Ooh, so all the pheromones and hormones are going to come into play here.
Well, do you mind if I just add one more thing? You were talking before about how Williams, for example, took less than 20% or something of their applicant pool. I mean, one of the things that I feel kind of offended about, this is my first child going to college, is I really feel manipulated. The Wall Street Journal had a piece of months ago about how colleges are deliberately former what were considered safe schools for certain kinds of students. That they're deliberately rejecting students so they can say, well, we only took X number, percent rather, of our applicant pool to make themselves look better.
Maureen, I'm gonna throw that to Bruce, and thanks very much for your call. Bruce, is there a kind of manipulation going on here, sort of Madison Avenue-style marketing to create stampedes and desire?
I think there are degrees of manipulation. Everybody does some, and then others do a little bit more, and what's the line? In fact, in our book, we have a whole chapter called Cutting Through the Propaganda, and it really is propaganda. I think that there is the most elite schools typically are pretty above board in their practices. It's the schools that are maybe a notch below that who are trying desperately to claw their way up, and it is true. Sometimes schools will try to gauge the interest of a student, and this is commonplace, whereas 10 years ago it would have been taboo. But if you don't interview, if you don't make the case that you're interested, even if your credentials make you admissible, a college will likely admit the one that they think is more likely to enroll.
Because they want that high acceptance rate.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about numbers. And if you put yourself in the shoes of an admission dean, they're looking at numbers, they're looking at acceptance rate, they're looking at SAT profile, they're going to go to the president, go to the board. And so it's very quantitative what they're looking for. And they gild the lily every way they can to try to make themselves look better.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, on the other side of the equation, families are making very emotionally loaded decisions here. Lots of judgments and perceptions of self-worth and how bright the future looks are being carried on shoulders this week.
Yeah, and they're bumping into a strange kind of institution here. I just want to go back to something Bruce said earlier. You know, in theory, higher education should be part of democracy, citizenship, mobility, opening doors. But there's an aristocratic principle built right into this premise of many are called, but very few are chosen. And what people are buying are the status, the patina of culture, the friends. But this is the higher education in selective, very selective and highly select colleges is becoming a positional good. In economics, that's a good that's defined only by the fact that I have it and you don't. There's no intrinsic difference. I mean, there's really not much intrinsic difference between an excellent education at UMass and one at Harvard. You get the same professors. Often they've had the same graduate schools. But the symbolic difference is just immense. And that's what people pay for. And this is a little bit like the British peerage. You know?
House of Lords is being created.
I think so.
Bruce Hammond, let me put that to you. Do you buy Jack's point that there's not much substantive difference, that it's all about sorting into kind of status groups?
Yes, I do. And you referenced the Williams study a while ago that said that having bright peers around you is a value added. I think that's true. I think that's one of the main rationales for going to one of these places is to get to rub shoulders with these incredible people. And full disclosure, I went to Yale University. I should probably put that on the table, and people can take that for what it is. But I would say that in the last 10 or 20 years, these public institutions have really put huge resources into their honors programs in an attempt to compete with these elite private colleges. So I'm not buying that the students at, let's say, Williams, a fine school, are much better than in an honors program at say, UMass, because the standards at those institutions has gone up dramatically in the last 10 years.
Well, we know they're competing as well. A friend in Phoenix, the son just got into Harvard and into Arizona, and is deciding for Arizona because it's a full ride, all tuition, all room and board, and thousands of dollars a year in travel money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's competing hard. Dennis is on the line. Welcome, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Two things I want to do. First of all, I want to make a plug for a couple of books by a fellow named Lauren Pope, P-O-P-E. One of the books is called Beyond the Ivy League, and the other is called Colleges That Change Lives.
Okay, we got the drift. And
both of those books talk about something that I know all of you are very concerned about, but I actually haven't heard in the discussion, which is learning. Mm-hmm. And they make the point that what college is primarily about is kids going someplace and learning, getting educated. It's not, you know, success and money and all that are great. I wish I had more of them. But college is primarily about kids getting a great education, and that's going to differ from kid to kid. And obviously the kids who can get into Harvard and U of M are going to do well any place, but where they're going to get the best education that meets their interests and learning style is a really different question, and it kind of concerns me. I have a doctorate. I've taught in university. Now I'm teaching in high school. It kind of concerns me to hear so much discussion about success and rubbing shoulders and not a lot about the
learning
mind and opening the mind to these kids.
It's a great point, Dennis, and thanks for calling to make it. We're looking at this whole bundle of things that float around college right now, and there's no question, Bruce Hammond, it is a crowded screen. Prestige is there, status is there, sense of self-worth, and then alongside that, Dennis is right. Learning's got to be there. Do you see families making that a central criteria, or are they just assuming that will happen on the other side of some kind of status sorting?
Yeah, this is certainly not enough make that, and the caller makes an excellent point. I think small is beautiful in education in the sense of having professors who value you, who you have a personal relationship with. Maybe you get internships, maybe you get summer fellowships. So there's definitely a strong case to be made for the small colleges in the world of higher education. And I think too often kids are swayed by who they see, you know, playing in the NCAA tournament or on Saturday afternoon. The name recognition has become such a huge factor. And so a reminder that it's really about education and that a lot of times small institutions that you may never have heard of mm-hmm. offer a great education, I think is very apt.
Masumi's on the line. Welcome, Masumi. You're on the air.
Hi. I went to school in Boston called New England Conservatory of Music.
Okay, famous school.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I just wanted to say I completely agree with the Mr. Hammond that I went to NEC because of the name.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree that I got a great education as far as performance opportunities and with teachers, but I think that I would have gotten a better academic education if I had gone to a public.
What makes you say that, Masumi? What makes you think that?
My sister went to a smaller, not very well known college. And I've spoken with her about music and what she's learning and things like that. She's a music major as well. And she's learned a lot more and had to do a lot more than I did. I know half of the things that she does.
So you're confirming that it's not all in a name, that lesser-known public school that your sister went to maybe did a better job in your perception.
Absolutely.
Masumi, thanks for your call. Bruce Hammond, is this a story that you hear repeated?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think you look at some of the smaller, lesser-known schools, they're the ones often that have intense loyalty from the graduates and often the ones who really focus on teaching and are not pouring huge sums into athletics and other things. And that's a totally different argument. But I'm a definite believer that you can get a great education at a school nobody's heard of.
Do most students understand that? Do most families understand? It, they must, because only a tiny portion go into these elite schools we've talked about.
I think they do, but you know, going back to that other caller, it's not all about education, unfortunately. And I think a lot of us in counseling try to remind. I make the case for small colleges on a daily basis with the students that I advise. But all these messages from the media and from the rankings and everything else are hard to counteract sometimes. So educationally is one thing, but we're in a competition here, and it's so seductive and alluring to get that big first prize ribbon that you can wear on your chest and put the decal on your back window. That's what we're talking about here, at least as much as we're talking about education.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to welcome in Anne McGrath. She's Special Projects Editor at U.S. News & World Report. She's editor of America's Best College Guidebook. Good evening. Welcome, Anne McGrath.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Anne McGrath, people have such an ambivalent attitude about this tremendously enticing list that you guys put out every year. It's right up there with the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue in terms of people grabbing it off the shelves. But why do you think it's become such a must-read, and what is the impact of your rankings on the way Americans think about college?
Well, I think that the reason that it's become so popular with families is that clearly people need guidance, and it's such an expensive and potentially life-changing decision that families are facing, and one that is going to be a huge investment for many families. And I think that with many guidance counselors, at least in public schools, being tremendously overworked and overwhelmed, families feel that they need, they're searching for any kind of help. And I think that our list, which, you know, while we ourselves don't advocate families using it in any by any means to sort of make a final decision based just on this list, I think that part of the appeal is it organizes a tremendously large and confusing universe of schools into groupings, and it lets the people see sort of how schools fall, where they might be able to fit academically, you know, their qualifications.
Give us a sense of that, of how you actually rank schools, Ann.
Okay, well, we survey 1,400 four-year accredited colleges every year for a number of different types of data that relate to the quality of student incoming students in terms of their academic qualifications. How well the schools perform in keep bringing freshmen back and graduating students in a timely fashion, how much committed they are to faculty and to small class sizes, a number of different things like that. And we also survey presidents and provosts and deans of admission to get their assessment of how the schools in their peer group measure up in terms of offering a quality education.
So what is your sense of what people should be looking for in this list? Are schools that are ranked number one or just in the top 100? Or give us some perspective on how these schools really stack up against one another.
I would love to do that. I think actually most, from what we understand of the research that's done by UCLA, the UCLA group every year of freshmen, I think that actually students, as a general population, probably use these lists in a wise way, which is sort of as a tool to refer to kind of get a sense of where schools fall in relation to one another, but then as just like one little piece of information amongst all of the other things they need to think about their own personality, their preferences, their social, and, you know, their desires in terms of a social and a cultural.
And what about the critique, Anne, that your list is essentially turning the whole thing into a game of status and elitism by ranking the entire nation's schools this way?
I really don't buy that. I think there is a sense among among the institutions. I do think there's a bit of gamesmanship going on among the institutions themselves, and maybe alumni, with this competition sort of atmosphere about how's my school doing and why does it appear to be dropping, or why does it, you know, we're delighted that it's going up. My sense from talking to families is that if any of that, I mean, and I'm sure there's an admissions frenzy going on out there. I know it's highly, highly competitive these days to get into many, even, you know, schools that years ago were considered to be safety schools. I don't really think that is a factor of the rankings. I think that's a factor of maybe largely demographics. The group is getting larger and larger, and the number of places in college just hasn't grown
to match it. Anne McGrath, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Anne McGrath is Special Projects Editor at U.S. News & World Report and Editor of America's Best College Guidebook. What do you think? What is the value add in a gilt-edged college diploma? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about college admissions and big decisions people are making right now all over the country, young men, young women, and their parents. Are we driving ourselves and our children crazy in the pursuit of brand name educations? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Bruce Hammond. He's co-author of The Fisk Guide to Getting into the Right College. And right now, from Spokane, Washington, by Gina Polignoni. She transferred from Washington State to Gonzaga University. Good evening and welcome, Gina.
Hello.
Hi. So you started out at a big state university, and went to a small private university midstream. Why did you do that?
Well, I just felt like the education I was getting at Washington State wasn't challenging enough for me. I know I was listening to your conversation earlier, and you were mentioning that sometimes the teachers aren't real focused on teaching at the bigger universities. They're more focused on athletics or research or things like that. At the smaller university, the teachers were definitely more focused on teaching. I went to college to learn, not to just get my degree, get my stamp of approval, and get out.
What did it mean for you financially to make the switch?
Oh, it was a big decision financially, really. I probably ended up paying more for my last year of college than for the first 3 years combined.
Was it worth it in your mind?
Oh, definitely. I don't regret it one bit. And I don't know. I don't think I really went for the prestige issue. I know you guys have been discussing that. That was probably part of it. But for me, it was just to get to a smaller university where you're more than just a number. You have smaller classes. You have teachers who have great experiences to share with students. Mm-hmm. And where you have students who are really interested, ambitious, motivated, inspired to learn.
So in your case, it was about the environment that you wanted to be in. It wasn't about future earning potential so much, I don't hear.
No, it was not about that at all. It was extremely about the environment. I went to college really to, sort of a personal growth thing and to learn as much as I possibly could, not really to up my, how much I'm going to make in the future.
Mm-hmm,
or anything like
mm-hmm.
that.
But, Gina, you have made distinctions. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Hey, you're welcome.
Bruce Hammond, here's a college student who got in one place, decided ultimately it wasn't for her, made an expensive decision to move. Is this common?
I think it is common, though I think usually the expense is going in the other direction. They are spending a lot and decide they want a less expensive place to go. But mm-hmm. I applaud her in terms of her approach. It sounds, that's the way we wish every student thought about things, and she's going to go there for the education. I would say, on the other hand, we've been talking a lot about prestige and maybe lamenting things. The flip side, though, is that it does give students something to shoot for.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that wanting to compete and wanting to be the best and wanting to excel and therefore go to the place where everyone else who excels is also aiming toward, I think we have to be careful if we're too negative about that idea,
mm-hmm.
because that is merit. That is the American dream in some sense.
Bruce, this is Jack.
Jack, are you arguing with that, Jack Beatty?
No. I just wondered, did you happen to see our article, The Organization Kid, by David Brooks in the Atlantic Monthly?
No, I missed that one.
Well, it was basically showing that, the pressures that this puts on kids, this competition and excellence early on, is sort of robbing them of their childhood. I mean, he talked to kids at Princeton who said, between the trombone lessons, the soccer practice, the vocal practice, the volunteerism, all the things we had to do to get positioned right for Princeton, we basically never got off this kind of 24/7 track.
What do you think, Bruce Hammond?
And we're getting the organization kid.
Yep. I'd say it's all about balance, and the pressures and pushes and pulls going down to grade school are something that we all get very concerned about, and I'll be candid and say that on my last job search, I interviewed in Boston and Washington, D.C., and I'm out here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the pressures, aren't quite so great.
So having a good time.
I'm definitely in tune with what he's saying. I agree completely. It's all a matter of balance, and the people who can stay in balance are the ones who are going to do well in life and in this process.
Lena is on the line. Welcome, Lena. You're on the air.
Thank you. Actually, I went to a University of California, and it wasn't one of the famous campuses.
Which school, Lena?
I went to Davis.
Okay, UC Davis.
Yes, and they have an excellent department for international relations, which I majored in, but I find that right now it's fairly detrimental to me. I mean, maybe
Why?
I did get an inferior education, but people look at my undergraduate education, and I got rejected from every single graduate school that I've applied to. And I must admit, I applied to some pretty prestigious universities because what I'm trying to do will probably take that sort of an education. And
how were your grades, Lena, if I may
I
ask?
I had good grades. I graduated with honors.
So
I graduated actually in 3.5 years.
So you're feeling typecast in some ways as a state college grad, and as if that's not good enough.
Exactly. And I must say that my career is not going very well. I don't know if it's because of that, but I'm doing something particularly brainless. And I feel that if I went to a more prestigious college, maybe I would get a little more attention at job interviews and at college interviews as well.
Bruce Hammond, what do you make of it? Here's Lena with a real-world situation.
Yeah, it sure is. I guess the thing I would say to that is that if you go to a lesser-known institution, I think it is probably a little more important to excel at that institution. And did sound like she did well,
mm-hmm.
and obviously every experience is different. But somebody in the middle of the class at, let's say, a very prestigious college is probably going to have a leg up on somebody in the middle of the class at a lesser-known school. But if the factors you think will play out actually do, on average, the student who goes to the less competitive environment hopefully will rank higher. And I think students who rank at the top at the places that are less known can hold their own and do well with respect to some of the ones that are a little more competitive.
Lena, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, you can hear a kind of anguish in Lena's voice. She made a bet on a state school, not a bad one, and she feels like she's got a headwind now as a result.
Yeah, that's just unfortunate. She's up against something that we all know is there. I mean, that's where class tells. That's what people are paying all those big bucks for at Harvard and all the rest of the places. It's a credential. It has an aura. It opens doors.
And yet the studies that we heard about earlier from Tom Redburn would say, hey, don't give up. If you hang in there, you can make a good living and a good life out of this.
Sure, if she can get through the door.
If she can get through the door. Bruce Hammond, do you agree?
First jobs. I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that in a first job right out of the gate, this can make a difference. I think second, third, fourth, and on after that, I'm not sure that it's going to be as much of a factor. So it can hurt right out of the gate a little bit, perhaps. But the other thing, I would make a distinction really between graduate school and employment. I do think that sometimes employers, on average, maybe can be swayed a little more. I think the professionals in graduate school admissions offices are paid to understand the credentials that are presented to them, and they know the more selective, less selective, they'll weigh that.
But the job world can and will be different. Bruce Hammond, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you.
Bruce Hammond is co-author of The Fisk Guide to Getting Into the Right College. And Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage of the day's news, check out our website, onpointradio.org. And our thoughts are with every family that's working on this tonight. Coming up, an inspiring message to high school seniors who didn't get into the college of their choice. This is On Point. It's a dreaded sight for college-bound high school seniors, the thin envelope from the college of their choice. In many teens' minds, rejection from a college represents failure on their part. Maybe if they had just studied a little harder or put a little more effort into that essay, but former Boston Globe columnist David Nyan sees things differently. Here, he reads from his classic column, To Those Who Got a No from an Admissions Dean.
The rejections arrive in early April in thin, cheap envelopes, some with a crummy window for name and address, as if it were a bill, and none with the thick packet you'd hoped for. Dear so-and-so, the admissions committee gave full consideration, but I regret to inform you we will be unable to offer you a place in the class of 2006. Lots of applicants, limited number of spaces, blah, blah, blah. Good luck with your undergraduate career. Very truly yours, Assistant Dean Blowhard, rejection writer, Old Overshoe University. This is the season of college acceptance letters, so it's also the time of rejection. You're in or you're out. Today's the day you learn how life is not like high school. To the ins who got where they wanted to go, congrats, great, good luck, have a nice life, see you later. The rest of this is for the outs. You sort of felt it was coming. Your SAT scores weren't the greatest. Your transcript had some holes in it. You wondered what your teacher's recommendations would really say or imply. And you can't help thinking about that essay you finished at 2 in the morning of the day you absolutely had to mail in your application. That essay which was, well, a little weird. Maybe you could have pulled that C in sociology up to a B-. Maybe you shouldn't have quit soccer to get a job to pay for your gas. Maybe it was that down period during sophomore year when you had mono and didn't talk to your teachers for 3 months while you vegged out. What difference does it make what it was? It still hurts. It hurts where you feel pain most, inside. It's not like the usual heartache that kids have, the kind other people can't see. An alcoholic parent, a secret shame, a gaping wound in the family fabric. These are things one can carry to school and mask with a grin, a wisecrack, a scowl, a just don't mess with me today attitude. But everybody knows where you got in and where you didn't. Sure, the letter comes to the house, but eventually you've still got to face your friends. Any mail for me is like asking for a knuckle sandwich. Thanks a lot for the kick in the teeth. What a bummer. How do you tell kids at school? That's the hard part. The squeals in the corridor from the kids who got in someplace desirable, the supercilious puss in the ones who got early acceptance, or the girl whose old man has an in at Old Ivy. There's the class doofus who suddenly becomes the first nerd accepted at Princeton, the 125-pound wrestling jock who, surprise, surprise, got into MIT. But what about you? You've heard about special treatment for this category or that category, alumni kids and a legacy ticket, or affirmative action luckouts, or rebounders, or oboe players. Maybe they were trying to fill certain slots. But you're not a slot. You're you. They can look at your grades and weigh your scores and see how many years you were in French club. But they can't look into your head or into your heart. They can't check out the guts department. This is the important thing. They didn't reject you. They rejected your resume. They gave some other kid the benefit of the doubt. Maybe that kid deserved a break. Don't you deserve a break? Sure, you'll get one. Maybe this is the reality check you needed. Maybe the school that does eventually take you will be good. Maybe this is the day you start to grow up. Look at some people who've accomplished a lot and see where they started. Ronald Reagan, Eureka College. Jesse Jackson, they wouldn't let him play quarterback in the Big Ten, so he quit Illinois for North Carolina A&T. Do you know that the chairman of both General Motors and General Electric graduated from UMass? Bob Dole, he went to Washburn Municipal University. The minority leader of the U.S. Senate, now majority leader, Tom Daschle, went to South Dakota State. Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, went to Northern Illinois University. Dick Armey, the House Majority Leader, took a bachelor's degree from Jamestown College. Winston Churchill, so slow a learner, they used to write his mother to please come take this boy off our hands. I know what you think. Spare me the sympathy. It still hurts. But let's keep this in perspective. What did Magic Johnson say to the little boy who also tested HIV positive? He said, "You've got to have a positive attitude." What happens when you don't keep a positive attitude? Don't ask. This college thing, what happened is that you rubbed up against the reality of big-time, maybe big-name institutions. Some they pick, some they don't. You lost. It'll happen again. But let's hope it won't have the same awful kick. You'll get tossed by a girlfriend or a boyfriend. You won't get the job or the promotion you thought you deserved. Some disease may pluck you from life's fast lane and pin you to a bed, a wheelchair, a coffin. That happens. Bad habits you can change. Bad luck is nothing you can do anything about. Does it mean you're not a good person? People like you, if not your resume. There's no one else that can be you. Plenty of people think you're special now, or will think that, once they get to know you. Because you are. And the admissions department that said no? Screw them. You've got a life to lead.
The great David Nayan is a former columnist for the Boston Globe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.